Real pleasure having you on Prison Pipeline talking about this exciting new development in the treatment of trauma and abuse that the people have experienced as before they're going into prison to help them heal from that.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been so good to be with you.
Thanks so much, and have a good night.
You too.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host at KABU. We prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Community Advisory Board will meet on Monday, May 12th at 6:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held. Thank you.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KABOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KABOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
If your eyes are on me, you're looking at country.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know why the hell I'm here.
and the hell I'm here. Because the woman I'm loving, you know she really, she really don't care.
Davy D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Everybody and their grandma and their other grandma and their grandma's grandma has been talking about the movie Sinners. There are so many layers and levels to this Ryan Coogler creation. I just saw a call for papers if you're in academia. There's a big gathering at Kinfolks this weekend to talk about it. Everybody has been excited. And I guess when you talk about art, art that moves people to examine it from every which angle you can is great. I just saw a listserv with a bunch of Asian folks looking at it. They want to talk about it. There's some indigenous folks that want to talk about it. Science fiction folks are like, let's look at this and, you know, examine the trajectory of vampires. But at the core of this movie was the music. And so I said, let me go get some heavy hitters. You know, I know a little bit about music, but I said, let me go get OGs, as they like to say, the real folks. And one of them is Daphne Brooks. She's a professor over at Yale University. She's the author of a couple of books. Is it three or four books? Let me wait. Let me make sure I get all your books, Daphne.
No, it's three.
It's three, right? One is Liner Notes, if I remember.
The Revolution.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The Intellectual Black Feminist Sound and Bodies in Descent, Spectacular Performances of Race and Freedom. So she's no slouch. She also puts on these huge conventions from, you know, James Brown on down to Beyonce. So welcome to this. And you were excited about the movie. You was like, oh, finally they're doing something that's in my wheelhouse. And we also have Quadro Dutterville, no stranger to our airwaves. He's a professor over here at SF State. He doesn't call himself a musicologist, but I do, because of his extensive work in jazz. He's with the Oakland Maroons, and he has some stuff to say. So Daphne Brooks, Professor Brooks, first question I got to ask you, when you saw this movie, what came to mind, especially musically?
Oh my God. I mean, first of all, it's just, you know, all flowers to Ryan Coogler, hometown brother, always puts a piece of the hometown, and in this case, in this film, a large piece of his homegrown roots into.
And let me just remind people, you are from the Bay Area, even though you're in Yale.
You know, that's home. Home is the Bay. And that's true for Ryan Coogler. I mean, I think I was a little bit speechless, especially with the most, at least in my world, the most talked about part of the film, in which it's one of the most stunning visual and sonic meditations in the history of film that focuses on the confluence of past, present, and future. Not just Black musical traditions, but American musical traditions, which we know are one and the same, and also Blackness being much greater and much older than this United States of America. So I was moved by it, and there was so much care and thoughtfulness that went into thinking about the politics and history of race and music that is manifest not just in that scene that I was alluding to, but also in relation to the vampire narrative as well.
Right. So, if you're just tuning in, we are talking about Sinners. We are going to talk about the film, where we are going to give spoilers. So if you ain't seen it, you know, catch us tomorrow. But we're going all in today with two esteemed people, and that was Daphne Brooks, who we just heard. Quadro Dutterville, what stood out for you music-wise when you saw this movie?
Wow. It's so many things, because it's kind of like what we call an embarrassment of riches, man. There's so much going on in it that it's hard to start in any one spot, and I think that's the beauty of the thing, is that it also warrants repeat viewings. It's what the other part of the cultural phenomenon that we're hearing. You know, did you see it? And are you going back? And everybody said, yeah, I'm going to go back and see that again, you know? because there's so much to pull from. And so if the one thing that comes to mind for me right now is this kind of allusions to Howlin' Wolf and also Robert Johnson, you know, the two main characters, Smoke and Stack, you know, is an allusion to Howlin' Wolf's signature tune, Smokestack Lightning, you know, which I, you know, which I dig so much. And the whole Robert Johnson thing, you know, the notion that, you know, these blues musicians are calling on some spiritual power that could be either, you know, malevolent or beautiful. So more on that later. I got some more thoughts about that later. Yeah.
The thing that stood out for me was not only the thing that you talked about, Daphne Brooks, Professor Brooks, where, you know, he does his montage of music, but was something that was actually unscripted. Delroy Lindo, one of the actors in there, talks about it when they're explaining some sort of tragedy that went on in the family. And you see him bang his hand on the car. And they were just coming from seeing another breadcrumb, which is the Chain Gang, which so much work songs and music comes from. So we saw that scene in itself, which was powerful. But then they're talking about you know, something tragic that happened, a hanging or something, and Delroy can't talk no more, and he just starts banging his hand on the car, and he's almost crying. They start singing, and then that hit me, you know, because it said to me that this music, our music, has so many functions, and when you can't find words, you always have the music. So I want to start off with you and get your expertise, Professor Brooks. This function of music, you know, what do we really need to know above and beyond that? Oh, it may sound good and it looks good, but the music is a form of expression that I don't think we fully explore and really have come to appreciate as Black folks.
Mm-hmm. I mean, thank you also for taking us back to that scene, which is a scene in which Delroy Lindo is recollecting the trauma of lynching, you know, and so absolutely what the philosopher, the great Black radical tradition philosopher Fred Bowden calls this, these moments of where words don't go, is where Black music can go. And so, you know, I mean, I what I appreciate about the film in relation to kind of opening up our relationship in 2025 to the history of the blues is to be able to think about the fact that the blues is, as Angela Davis has written so beautifully, it's a music of post-emancipation, but also the great scholar, Black radical tradition scholar, Sadia Hartman would say emancipation itself was also a non-event in many ways, that the time of slavery continues on in a different form. And so the blues becomes this kind of expressive device that enables us to, you know, reclaim our personhood, to be able to articulate our deepest sorrows, but to also lean into and to claim possession of our sensuality for the first time outside of systemic surveillance and slavery, right? It's a music of protest. It's a music of sociality. It is world making, and that is something that the film itself, you know, makes very clear in the context of the Juke, which Zora Neale Hurston very famously wrote about in her 1934 essay "Characteristics of Negro Expression." The Juke is kind of the microcosm for Black life, right? So you very much get that in the film, and I just feel like they captured that so richly.
Right. Before I bring Quadro back in, because I know your time is short, I want you to put on your other hat, because you just did a conference with Beyonce. And
he was not there, but we did do a conference about Beyonce. Yeah. She's tied up with us.
Yeah. She was tied up. Yes. But what I think happened was that her doing a country album set off a firestorm of conversation. There was a conversation before when she did Renaissance, but it was looking at things about the history of house and all that. But I want to come back to the country thing, because that's where a lot of folks were like, well, we invented country, but then it's forced folks to have to really explore. Well, what do you mean? What does it look like? Yeah. And I think there was, in doing so, a couple of things emerged. One, people really started to find these roots, which I think eventually takes them to blues. Yes. And they're like, oh, wow, this is great. Right. And the other thing, too, one of the most popular music forms right now, they may call it trail music. you know, but when you're, you know, when I go to Texas, it ain't Kendrick Lamar that they're screaming for.
Right.
That's it ain't, right. it ain't, you know, it ain't even Beyonce as much, but it's like, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember these names. It's all these other folks, King George and all that, that rule the day. And it's this bluesy kind of modern thing. And it's young people's music. So I want to come back, you know, this interest in going back deeper. And I think Ryan really opens up the pathway for us to go deeper. What is going on right now that so much, that we're really going back and kind of discovering these roots in ways that I think we weren't doing maybe even a year ago?
Right. I mean, I would be interested in hearing what you all think of it. I mean, I do think there are folks like Beyonce who, you know, has stepped into the role of being a cultural historian, especially with this trilogy that is clearly about reclaiming, you know, the music that was always ours. I heard that one of the t-shirts at the concert that just opened on Monday night says, "Never ask permission for something that you already own, that's already yours," right? So she's being very clear about the politics of possession and cultural property and, you know, the history of cultural appropriation. And I do think this music right now, you know, somebody like Gary Clark Jr. out of Texas, you know, has been embraced by a variety of different publics, not just, you know, white fans of the blues. I don't know. I think that there's maybe a way that social media and technology has at least opened up further access to a new generation to be able to explore these seemingly older musics, which of course are the DNA of everything in our world right now. But I'd be curious in hearing what you all think is the reason why this is happening right now.
Quadro, what do you think about that?
I think that at certain points in our history, there are these convergences where the blues, you know, evolves right before our eyes. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying this one because of the multidisciplinary nature of the way these blues, this particular blues artifact, this film Sinners is a blues and artifact, has come to life and become like a, you know, more of a Black popular culture artifact of people going to it, talking about it and saying, "I'm going to go back again," right? You know, in the past, you know, the blues evolved in certain things. Like we were talking about, you were talking about country music just a moment ago, and that brought to mind for me the Ray Charles album, where he did, you know, some country music. But there's this overlap and imbrication between his blues and this country music that just brings into stark light, you know, how these two things are married together and have been doing a call and response, you know.
Yes. Yes. Very much so. And sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. This is a call and response right now. I'm agreeing with you in order to also say that, you know, we're being reminded right now with Beyonce and Rihanna Giddens' collaborations on Texas Hold'em, quite a bit of discussion about how the perception of country and the blues and what was called hillbilly music at the turn of the century were all a part of a vernacular American culture. They were all mixed up, right? And the ways in which the recording industry and racial capitalism, you know, felt the need to divide up, to taxonomically categorize these forms was, you know, kind of the cultural arm of Jim Crow. So to really be able to speak to that right now when we are in a, you know, a resurgent moment of Jim Crow seems especially powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And from my standpoint, my examination of history, I'm seeing also this nature, the blues, Black music, Black ontology, basically, as you know, H-Rap Brown mentioned, you know, Black folks gave white folks back their bodies to a certain degree. So there was something that was jettisoned, I believe, in European ontology and neo-European ontology that somehow devolved into quote unquote whiteness that was lost. And to retrieve that aspect of humanity, Black music was there, basically. The influence of Black music was there. And blues being at the root of it many times, you know, in the beginning of modernity with people documenting it, and also in the 1960s with this cultural awakening where you have, you know, these white boys from Britain like Eric Clapton and, you know, John Mayhall and all that kind of stuff, you know, paying tribute, you know, to these people openly and saying, yeah, this is where we got it from. And oftentimes what is not spoken of is the ontological influence of such a thing. Their mannerisms, these white men's mannerisms and way of being is being modeled after, these black models of one, black masculinity and, mm-hmm. and other, and other things. You know, you have Howlin' Wolf and Buddy yeah. Guy, who is in this particular film. You know, they're modeling themselves on how these Chicago electric blues musicians yeah. carry themselves. Yeah. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, there's so many layers. There's the ontological layer. There's the notion of African spirituality showing up in this thing. The notion of the quote unquote the devil's music, when the film opens and Saul Williams, as the preacher, is talking to, his son, and brings up this notion about, one of these times you're gonna usher in the devil. This mm-hmm. whole secular and spiritual thing, that balance, it shows mm-hmm. up in all parts of mm-hmm. black music, of the artist standing in the middle at this crossroads. Mm-hmm. And I'll get back to more of that.
Yeah, well, we're even having that discussion right now.
Mm-hmm.
Within hip hop.
Right.
I mean, if you keep doing that drill music, right. you're going right. to bring in the devil, literally.
Yeah,
sacred and profane.
But what's crazy mm-hmm. about it is yeah. that, and I was just talking to my class, I remember 20 years ago when Little John and Crime Mob and crunk music was happening, yeah. and they said, that's the devil, literally said it's the devil's music. But like about a month ago, I'm at a wedding and we're playing Knuck a Few Buck, and mm-hmm. and it's a classic. So it seems like what we see as profane suddenly mm-hmm. becomes in style. But go ahead, Daphne.
Well,
Professor
Brooks. I just wanted to play along with the chorus here and to also say that one of the most refreshing and I think most radical arguments that this film is making, though, and kind of interventions in the mythical discourse around the blues, the mythical narrative of Robert Johnson at the crossroads with the devil, and the kinds of exchanges that you make for expressive powers that's, rooted in something that is, deeply profane, is that ultimately the film is suggesting that we need to think about, what constitutes evil, and that white supremacy, is the root of evil, and that that is the greatest threat to, black vitality and survival, is not just, white supremacy as a systemic catastrophe, but its rapaciousness, right, that is manifest in the allegory of the vampire. So mm-hmm. at first I was really hesitant when the film started. I said, oh my God, are we doing this, devil and the blues thing, and then it actually, goes so much deeper to encourage us to think about, the material history of, what constitutes, the evil undercurrents of, American life and Black people's will to survive and improvise their way through, this like logic of evil.
Professor Brooks, help us clarify the Robert Johnson story a little bit. Okay, so the story was, and this is what is implied on the surface when we watch the thing, Robert Johnson went to, was in Mississippi, wanted to become a good guitar player, was on the crossroads in the middle of the night and made a deal with the devil, and that's what happened. And at the time, nobody knew who he was. He became famous, and mm-hmm. I want to come back to this later, when a white audience discovered him kind of in the 40s and 50s, and the guy wanted to do this big concert. I'm going to remember his name. Wanted to do a big concert in Carnegie Hall. I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do. He went to Yale from John.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, it's a white promoter who loved black music, and he's the one that said, this is the king of blues. And and so he does this thing at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
And so ever since then, there's been this whole myth about, he went in and he sold himself to the devil, which mm-hmm. kind of fortified the notion of blues being devil's music. So from mm-hmm. this... From your profession, mm-hmm. what is the story? What do we really
need to understand? You just told the story. John Hammond, by the way.
John Hammond, yes. John Hammond,
okay.
yes.
Mm-hmm. From my perspective, what is the what is the story of that story?
Yes.
I mean, you know, right? The mythology around it, you know, I think has been, you know, it's been a kind of confluence of the exoticization and the demonization of Blackness in American culture, but also the ongoing systemic ways in which Black virtuosity and Black genius has been eviscerated, has been tied to not only something that, you know, is anti-sacred, you know, is all about it, an amoral kind of, you know, structure of feeling, but, you know, also has no kind of claim to its own invention and craft, right? So I mean, I think that mythology has been, you know, complicated by, you know, white supremacist knowledge production for a century now, you know.
Right. And it's real easy to write off our genius.
Absolutely.
And say, did we build the pyramids? No, spaceships came and did it.
Right.
Did you really learn how to play the guitar? Well, you probably made a deal with the devil, son, you know. So yeah. And then I guess to your other point, what is really the devil? What is really evil? And I think listening to Ryan Coogler, he was saying, look, there's a whole body of work that says that there's always been these conversations with God to, you know, to obtain the thing. And they called it into a devil thing, but this is quite natural to, you know, I've had my conversations with the Lord and been like, look, God, if you let me kick butt tonight, you know, if the Warriors win tonight, God, I will do these seven things.
Yes. Well, and that the film gives us a kind of a reclamation and a redefinition of the kind of spirituality that's always been familiar to us, our conversations with the ancestors and our mindfulness of that kind of, you know, the potency of, you know, cultural and social genealogies that become manifest in the forms that we have created. So
real talk. So before I let you go, two or three things that you want to leave our audience with from the mind of Professor Daphne Brooks, Yale University, you know, ethnomusicologist, among other things. What do you want us to really focus on if we go see the movie a second or third time?
Oh, I mean, everyone should see it multiple times. And I love it so much. I do, you know, to go back to Angela Davis, I appreciate the fact that there are there's a genius blues woman in the film, you know, who, not to give spoilers away, but, you know, does not fare so well. But we have her performance that's kind of sitting at a moment of heightened tension. And I would want people to keep that in mind, even as we also focus on how brilliant Miles Caden was, you know, in summoning the spirits of Charlie Patton, the spirits of, you know, everyday Black musicians, which we come to find out is really where that guitar came from. But that there is, you know, the breakthrough blues musicians that opened up the form to the national and the global imaginary were the women. You know, Mamie Smith was the first African-American to record a blues, and that, you know, there are all sorts of systemic problems as to why that was the case and why there were white folks who claimed that they were recording the blues before Black folks did when Mamie Smith broke through in 1920. But her recording Crazy Blues ushered in this, you know, phenomenon of the rise of the classic, you know, blues queen who'd always been, you know, leading the ten shows from Ma Rainey to her protege Bessie Smith to Ethel Waters to Alberta Hunter. So those sisters are as crucial as Blind Lemon Jefferson and Charlie Patton and Son House and, you know, all of the brothers that are being summoned in this film too. So I think that's what I want to leave you with, and also the beauty of the. And you alluded to this, Davey, the cultural heterogeneity in the film, especially with the presence of Asian American folk and indigenous folk. I do wonder about where the Latinx folk were, but you can't do everything in a film. So I'm just so thrilled and moved by this film, and I hope that they continue to get their flowers.
Real talk. Professor Daphne Brooks, I know she's in the middle of classes, so thank you for joining us this afternoon. Welcome back to the Bay via the airwaves, and we will talk to you, and thank you.
Thank you so much. A pleasure speaking with the both of you.
Continue our conversation with Quadro Dedeville, and you know, one of the things that you were talking about was that you had wished. You know, we all have these wish lists after the movie. That when you saw the name Smoke and Stack, you was asking the question, "Why did he play Howlin' Wolf?" So, what's the backstory? Who's Howlin' Wolf? What Smoke and Stack have to do with this? And why did you ask that question as somebody who knows your music?
Woo! Okay, there's so much that I want to go into. I don't want to like digress all the way into a Howlin' Wolf bio, but you know, suffice it to say that Howlin' Wolf is one of the most significant blues men, you know, of the 20th century, and his signature tone or his signature part of his vocals was this wolf-like howl, this black, you know, this howl that he would give out, and one of the greatest tunes that he did with that particular sound in it was a tune called Smoke Stack Lightning. And you know, one of the reasons why this thing is on my wish list for the film is not just because of the use of the term Smoke and Stack, the two main protagonists, but also because, you know, I'm reading the film through this very you know, African spiritual and specifically Yoruba lens. And, you know, I'm a practitioner of Yoruba spirituality, Ifa, Isheshe. And so a lot of this stuff, including, I'm gonna get back to that in a minute, this story about Robert Johnson has connections to that. And so when I hear Smokestack Lightning and the tune, I'm thinking of the, you know, the African Yoruba Orisha of Shango, which is for justice, basically. You know, and I'm seeing these, you know, two brothers coming back to this town, basically trying to get some justice for the people who are working in the fields in this town, these cotton fields in this town, and they're trying to, you know, organize a juke joint, basically, where these people can get some sort of wellness there. And what happens with our music and our cultural expression, oftentimes here in the belly of the beast, is that these, you know, Neo-Europeans, these outside forces, try to commodify or appropriate that cultural expression. And so from my standpoint, the whole moral of the film is about them trying to come in and the people who are inside deciding on who can come in and who cannot and what dangers there are in doing so. This is sort of like the parable, you know, of this deep film, the many layers, you know, of this film. So that's one take on Howlin' Wolf. The other thing is about Robert Johnson, that, you know, our esteemed guest here just mentioned, that story about Robert Johnson, you know, has some layers to it as well, because the Robert Johnson story takes place at a crossroads. And within, you know, Yoruba cosmology, Eshu, who is a messenger and the controller of language, the communicator, the translator, this is who Eshu Alegwa is. He dwells at the crossroads for obvious reasons. Like, this is where people and thought and different things intersect and meet. And at the center of that is Eshu Alegwa saying who, and he's a gatekeeper. He decides who comes in and who does not, which I think is, you know, very relatable to this movie right here. And so, you know, the power of the one brother's music to bring in all these spirits inside the juke joint. And also, you know, that call going out also to these other malevolent spirits as well. You know, it's a very layered, you know, parable in this film. That's what I enjoyed so much about it. Also, the notion of Robert Johnson being at the crossroads and having this discussion with, in quotation marks, the devil. My take on that is that this was just a perversion of African spirituality, because in reality, what he's dealing with there is Eshu Alegwa, and just the notion of communication and empowering for communication, of open the way to clear communication. And the outside forces that I was talking about, the Neo-Europeans, look at that, and they designated Eshu as the devil. And this has been consistent both in Haiti with Legba and in Brazil with Candomblé and Umbanda houses, where they call Eshu the quote-unquote devil, and almost and oftentimes depict Eshu as the devil. So we, in a way, we need to get the whole devil notion out of our mind and understand that these are also African diasporic people engaging in a very deep and multi-layered African diasporic practice that came to be known as the blues. Yeah.
Well, let's take that a little bit deeper, because the notion of devil music is not just situated with outside forces, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can hear, you know, you've seen those documentaries where Adam Clayton Powell and Du Bois and others are frowning on the blues, right? Let's be clear.
Yes.
You know, they were frowning on the blues and like, this is not good music. And it's something that is going to hold us back, and it's an embarrassment. And that whole notion of a middle class, and I don't even want to just limit it to middle class, but there is a notion of respectability politics. There is a notion that showing that sort of blackness can hold us back, but there is an ilk, you know, there a substantial ilk that looks at the rawness of black expression and sees it as something that is an embarrassment, from blues to jazz to hip hop. And even within hip hop to this day, we're having this discussion, you know, like, I don't like Chief Keef, and I don't like these folks, and I like more Public Enemy, and I need more Dead Prez, is a debate, you know.
Yes.
And there can be some merit within the community if somebody is singing about killing somebody and selling keys. And at the same time, maybe that's a pretense because you're just afraid of the raw blackness that is being expressed. You know, you know, I mean, because I remember a long time ago when Public Enemy and those guys were out, there were people that said they were violent and that their music was, you know, was literally the devil's music. And this was Public Enemy. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, I don't like the cursing. You know, I don't like their costumes. I don't like. So let's dig into this, because that seems to be embedded, you know. Yeah. And I'll close even with Ray Charles, who you mentioned, you know, doing soul music, right? And they was mad as hell. Excuse the pun. They was like, you took all the stuff out of gospel music, you know, the elongating of notes, the rhythm, all that stuff, and you put it into a secular thing. You're the devil.
Okay. So, wow, you just gave me a couple of things, many things actually to talk about within the context of that. So with Du Bois and Adam Clayton Powell, we have to take into consideration too, you know, their Judeo-Christian training and upbringing. Oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes that can carry some Eurocentric belief systems as well. So even in Souls of Black Folk, as rooted in music, as Souls of Black Folk was, with him prefacing each of the chapters with some lyrics and things of that nature, pieces of music. Even within the context of that book, he says something about the, you know, the African god Obi, the god of evil, or something like that. You know, basically maligning African spirituality. So you know, these people have, you know, limitations in their understanding sometimes. But I think part of the difficulty is the complexity between, you know, what is spiritual and what is secular in African and African diasporic cultural expression and in society. Because I've heard even the Judeo-Christian preachers here in the United States, one in particular, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name right now, but he said, in reality, you know, amongst Black people, African diasporic people, no matter where you find us in the world, there is no dichotomy between the sacred and the profane. Like everyday life, we find spiritual, you know, significance in all of these things. And that's where some of the uneasiness comes in Ray Charles taking some aspects of gospel, you know, and infusing it into a popular culture music, you know, Prince.
Was it some or all? Because it looked like he took all of, you know, Ray Charles took everything.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm not going to. I won't quibble. I won't quibble on percentages. All I know is that it's pretty consistent. You know, Marvin Gaye struggled with this. Prince struggles with this same thing between being, you know, the sexualized object and also this, you know, harbinger of something spiritual. And there's the complexity too of them not being able to be as focused and intentional about the spiritual side as they are about the sensual side. And so there's also this, rather the sexual side. And I'm differentiating between those two things too. There's a difference between something that has sensuality to it and something that just has raw sexuality to it. The industry wants to market raw sexuality, wherein, you know, all of Black music may have very much, you know, a lot of sensual, you know, notions to it without it being, you know, stripped away to it to the point where it's just basically, you know, sex, quote unquote, sexuality. And so that's the difference that I would look for in those musics, Davey. And sometimes they, you know, they're riding in the same car together, is that the industry is doing a certain thing and you can see where the industry is steering you towards a certain thing. And you can also see the artist trying and sometimes it's struggling with trying to get to that spiritual and sensual aspect of it, which is much more elevating. And so to take it back to the metaphor of the movie Sinners, these vampires, you know, especially the, you know, the Irish Neo-European guy that's standing on the outside of the juke joint, trying to get them to come outside the communal formation that they have inside of the juke joint. Him trying to get them outside and into that group would take him into just the raw, you know, hedonistic, sexual, et cetera, and so forth. Whereas I believe, you know, inside the juke joint, there are two things taking place. The ancestors are there, but there's also a little bit of, you know, the raw, you know, sexual thing going on as well. So that may be the reason why it was called, you know, the vampires are being called to begin with. That's why they come knocking on your door. That's why, you know, man, should I do that? Should I name names and the industry name? I'm gonna leave that alone. But there's certain people, you know, names we all could name and that came to bear on hip hop, wherein, you know, it went into its decline to a certain degree. These, you know, there are certain people that came to, you know, to touch the industry and begin to just curve it towards, you know, raw, you know, degeneracy, I think.
A couple of things you said, Quadro Dudeville, talking about the music and Sinners, if you're just tuning in and getting ready to wrap up in a minute, but when you said there's no difference between the profane and the spiritual, so to speak, they live in the same thing. The thing that makes Black music magical is that it's not something that is just heard, it's felt.
Yes.
And what you saw, you know, when Lindo does this scene that's unscripted, Delroy Lindo, right? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of folks felt that. You know, when he's talking about that, and he, you know, he smashes his hand on the car, and you could feel that. You could feel that pain. You could feel that sorrow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and all those musicians in the car could go along. And when he told us that, man, you know, that wasn't even in the script, that just shows you the power of the music, right?
Yes.
Like, well, we got to have to keep it in there because this thing is. So I say that to say that, as much as some people may not like it, some of the most profane stuff, you can feel it. Mm-hmm. You can feel it to its core. And you're like, yo, I know I'm not supposed to like this music, but that dude singing about pimping, I'm feeling it to my bone, because what he's doing is conviction. And maybe a lesson that we need to learn is that maybe the devil acts with conviction, but you don't act with conviction towards your sacred.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, you're kind of half stepping. The devil, you know, whatever you want to define that is, you know, and to kind of say this, I remember Suge saying this. We were at a convention, and we were on a panel. And he says, man, I'm a gangster. I'm a die gangster. This is who I am. He was saying it with his chest, and you could feel him. He was like, this is who I am. Who are you? And you know, like, were you able to match that energy, not to try and out gangster him, but could you match that energy to be just as righteous? Could your righteousness match his evil? Now, sometimes the evil that we're dealing with is amplified and reinforced by the music industry, which you talked about. It's amplified by society, which finds that to be its comfort zone. We're experiencing that at this very moment, you know. But have we mastered being able to go deep into the spiritual practices that you were talking about, or even to really commune with God if we're coming out of the Judeo-Christian thing? Are we really riding hard, you know, for what we believe? Or are we kind of like, you know, maybe I should go on this side and dibble dabble in stuff that looks nice, but I'm not really built for it?
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I think the artist is in a very difficult position, but we're at a point now, at a crossroads now, where there's really only one sane choice for our survival. And that is to get very serious about the spiritual thing and also identify, you know, because also in the film, there's a point at which the brother who was at the door, you know, who was the gatekeeper, supposed to hold us safe, he becomes one of these vampires and comes back to the door and tries to come back in. And the moral of this story is you have to tell people who, you know, who are at the door and failed at being gatekeeper, a safety person for our culture and our village, and also became one of those vampires, you can't come in either. So at a certain point, our spirituality, we have to take on the role of, you know, understanding.
But this is what the church was doing to Ray Charles and Sam Cooke. They used to call you backsliding. You can't come back in. You can't. But you know who they couldn't deny? Aretha Franklin.
Right.
She was able to go back and forth, and maybe even Rosetta Tharpe, you know, because she was back and forth too.
Absolutely.
So that becomes a yin and yang. So is it a thing of when you are convicted, when you're doing it with conviction and I feel you and I can't deny what I'm feeling, that you're given a pass? Or you know what I mean? There's some layers to that.
Yeah. It takes, I'm not going to say it's easy. You know, it's going to take some sophistication to parse out, what do they say, the wheat and the chaff, you know? Of course, you know, that's going to take some sophistication to know where those outsiders have their hands in the game. And we should call that, all I'm saying is we should call that particular aspect of it out, and I'm feeling what you're saying in that those that are working with spirituality, whether it be some Judeo-Christian spirituality or the African spirituality, be as serious and about what's happening as these folks who are, you know, with intention, you know, basically destroying the village, you know, willfully destroying the village for some money, for some silver.
We're gonna have to wrap up. We've been talking with Cardro Dutterville, but I'm gonna let you get some last comments before we do. We're talking to Professor Daphne Brooks. This is not a one and done conversation. This is just one aspect of the movie Sinners that we're dwelling into. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Looking at the music, I'm gonna get some of these blues artists on and all that. But I wanted to start off the one of the conversations. I know there's going to be big discussions this weekend. You know, I think at Kinfolk, you know, the cafe. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on. But go ahead. You got the last words there.
In the beginning, you had mentioned both the representation of Asian folk and also of the Indigenous First Nations folk. And I was really well pleased with that. I want to say that Black filmmakers have done, I think, an exemplary job oftentimes with portraying Indigenous First Nations peoples. I go back to as far as Buck and the Preacher and Sidney Poitier's directed film in their portrayal of the Indigenous First Nations peoples. And in this particular film, when I saw them ride out in those costumes that Ruth Carter, let's call her name out again, Ruth E. Carter, Sister Ruth E. Carter on the costuming designs, that looked like a movie that I want to see, you know?
Yeah.
The Indigenous First Nations
I want to see a spinoff
yeah,
of that. I want to see a spinoff, and I want to see what they were dealing with, because remember, right, they were chasing them.
There
so there's a whole story. So Ryan Coogler, if you're listening,
I want to see
the Indigenous side of that story.
Exactly.
You know, because there's a story to tell there.
Yeah. Secondarily, the portrayal of the Asian couple and their child, I thought was really intriguing, and I liked the fact that once her husband, the Asian woman's husband, was outside of the juke joint and had been caught, you know, up with and being basically victimized by these vampires, that she was the one said, "Look, let's saddle up and ride. Look, let's get this popping right now." Right now. I like the assertiveness that Ryan Coogler infused that character with, because oftentimes in film, as we well know, Asian women are stereotyped as being, you know, meek and quiet in a lot of the films. So I really like the assertiveness of that.
And
character.
she was the first one to put the stake in the husband's heart.
There you go.
To free him. Remember, the stake was to free them.
I hear you.
And so we're gonna have to have a whole other conversation, mm-hmm, because he didn't put the stake in. You know, I don't know which one was smoking, which one was stacked, but he didn't put the stake. You let him live.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So that's a whole other level of conversation, and what was that about, and what deal was cut.
Yeah.
And not to forget, Buddy Guy was in the movie too.
Absolutely, man. The whole Chicago connection, because all of that electric blues, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, you know, and of course the legendary Buddy Guy at 88 years of age, man. All of that stuff is so influential to 20th century music. If you look at, you know, there was a young guitarist around the time when these Chicago electric players are getting known, and Muddy Waters did this album called Electric Mud with a guitarist on it named Pete Cozy, who revolutionizes Miles Davis's band in the mid-1970s by infusing it with this electric avant-garde blues jazz sound. So there's branches of it that kick into all these other, you know, pieces of music and turn up with people like James Blood Omer and others. The last thing I want to say, there's so much to say about this film. Last thing I wanted to say about this film was I was really intrigued and pleased by Professor Daphne's mention of who it is we have that basically validates, you know, whether we've done something, you know, or not. In the music, in blues music. And there's this notion of intellectual property also. So we have to also look at the meta curatorial aspect of Ryan Coogler's film, in that 25 years from now, that intellectual property, that film becomes his again. He has basically revolutionized the industry in terms of doing that and cementing the intellectual property basically of this film, the whole tradition and notion that's being expressed in this film. He says, "I want this back. This is Hollywood does not own this," you know?
And that's important. And as I said, this is not a one and done conversation. It's the tip of the iceberg, one of many conversations, because there's so many layers and levels. So Quadro Dedeville, thank you so much. And also Professor Daphne Brooks, we're gonna take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Ralph and out. Peace.
Smokestack lightning, shining just like gold. yell. Oh, don't you hear me cry? Ooh. 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 Oh, tell me, baby, why did you
crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Bellevue.
Come on.
Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beef. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with their great bread making his peace. Say the peace to their lovers I name.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
This is Cy Khan. I spend most of my time in North Carolina, but when I'm in the Pacific Northwest, I turn my dial to KBOO music for the rest of us. Oh, yeah.
This is Bird Note. It's early May. We're standing in a large hayfield in western New York State, where bobolinks are returning to nest. The males are first to arrive. Their black and white plumage makes them look, it's been said, as if they're wearing tuxedos backwards. In about a week, the females, too, will complete a round-trip journey of more than 12,000 miles from the pampas of Brazil and Argentina. Why are there now so many fewer bobolinks than in decades past? Probably because the landscape of North America has changed so much. Bobolinks originally nested on native prairies of the Midwest and southern Canada. When much of this grassland came under intense cultivation, they expanded their range eastward to hayfields and meadows. Bobolinks like large, infrequently plowed fields that offer broad-leaved plants, under which the females build their nests directly on the ground. In the Northeast, there are fewer hayfields, and many have been converted to alfalfa, vegetation bobolinks don't normally use. Also, hayfields are now being mowed earlier than they used to be, and the mowing coincides with the peak of bobolink nesting. Support for federal and local efforts that conserve grassland habitat can help these far-flying birds. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek, Vice President of KBOO's Board of Directors. Are you passionate about KBOO Community Radio and its mission? Do you want to use your